You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey, 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 and greetings, listeners. You're tuned in to episode 12 of Fly on the Call, candid conversations on music. Today's guest is Alex Lechman of Death is a Business, a self-described heavy metal band with an identity crisis. The band has been around in various forms since 2013 and just released their debut full-length, Not Infinite, on Halloween. The album has been in the works for close to 5 years, with many collaborators and recording sessions coming together throughout that time. In this conversation, Alex and I discuss the process, the need for community, artistic value, and a whole lot more. So let's run the theme music and get things started.
Today I worked at a magazine where I cover drug policy. Just came off of a big drug policy conference last week in St. Louis, so we're trying to do a lot of coverage around that event.
Oh, cool. So I'm curious, like, now that the album's out and stuff, like, what have you been like working on with the band lately?
So things are happening very much in real time. Today's Tuesday, so yesterday on Monday, we announced an event, a launch party for the album that's going to be in December 6th. But it's a lot more than a launch party, actually. It's going to be, it's something that I've been wanting to do for a long time, and now I have the chance to do it. It's a celebration of New York's artists and activist communities. So, basically we're going to have a live round table of local artists and activists, and then they're going to perform in a live music showcase. And, you know, I am included amongst them, and I'm co-organizing this event. Some treats and psychedelic arts, you know, we're going to have vendors for guests to like engage with. And we're also going to have on-site drug overdose prevention training. So we're going to be training guests and how to use naloxone or Narcan, which in case you don't know, it's the antidote to an opioid overdose. So this event is going to be a very special coming together of a lot of different facets of my career and community that are important to me.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, my job is, I do like data entry for an ambulance billing company. So I'm very familiar with Narcan. Unfortunately, there's a lot of those types of calls that I have to enter.
Yeah. And you know, it's obviously a huge issue here in New York City. We have, you know, drug overdose deaths, mostly from fentanyl contamination of just like the whole illicit drug supply, even stuff like cocaine, methamphetamine, MDMA. You know, most people think it's just something that's found in heroin, but it's something that's being found in like most any drug now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really important for people in the community to be informed about how to use Narcan and just to sort of combat the stigma around, you know, people using drugs and that sort of thing.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, the whole idea of you like planning that event like kind of shows how like connected you are with the kind of community around, like you said, like the music and art scene. Could you talk a little bit about like that and like kind of how you've found your place in there and how it affects the band and stuff?
Yeah. So yeah, I actually want to reference again the event, the conference I was at last week. So the reason, like really the impetus behind this event is, so I've kind of had, you know, for like over 10 years, had my feet in two different worlds. There's been the music world, and then there's been the world of, you know, political activism. And these are, you know, both things that are very, and actually, you know, I got into specifically drug policy activism or advocacy through music, you know, through learning about the history of American pop music and the counterculture movement and psychedelics and the war on drugs. So, you know, the two of them are very much tied together for me. But to make it real simple, you know, I realized through performing shows here in New York City that the music community, the music scene is just way too insular. You know, everyone is just very individualistic, focused on their own thing, just trying to get fans. You know, it's very cutthroat. It's just a dog eat dog music scene. But, and then on the other hand, you know, the world of political activism and advocacy has a lot of its own problems. And, you know, just, I think that there's, you know, there's a tendency to become hyper-focused on policy and legislation and leave out things like music and community and culture and the things that, like, really bring people together. You know, music brings people together and helps people find common ground like almost nothing else. So, you know, to bring it to, so for the event that we're doing, this is our way of trying to bridge those gaps. Mm-hmm. And to, you know, bring those communities together and help them kind of exchange ideas.
I think I had read that like the live record you did last year kind of came in a similar way through like you performing at like a cannabis convention or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, could you talk a little about like that record? And I know there were like a bunch of different musicians featured on that and on the new record as well. But could you talk a little about like how all that stuff kind of comes together for you?
Sure. So I think really to make it really simple, the live album that we did last year, I think for me, the reason that record is special to me is that was kind of putting on wax a community of musicians that I feel like I've helped cultivate here in New York City, just, you know, amongst my friends and different artists and bands that I've been playing with, and you know, house parties and other events that we've been putting on together. So that, like, the thing that's the most important to me about that record is it was a way for me to bring together, you know, a cast of different artists, singers, and musicians who've all maybe played, known each other, been a part of different communities, but, you know, that was my way of bringing everyone together under one roof to make this collaborative live album in my basement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and like even now, you know, less than a year later, you know, unfortunately, communities aren't always, you know, don't always stick around. And, you know, music scenes are constantly changing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of the relationships that came together for that record, you know, maybe have drifted apart or maybe, you know, some of the artists haven't kept up with each other, but, you know, I wanted to capture that moment in time and have it serve, I guess, have, you know, kind of show like a different model of making music together amongst different artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, like you mentioning kind of like scenes and communities changing all the time. I think it's interesting how, like you said, that's kind of like a picture of one point in time, but, the new record kind of took, you know, like 5 years plus to put together. So it's, you know, a very different kind of snapshot in that way. How has that kind of, that process of, and so much time, like, affected kind of the finished product and how you, like, view it now?
Well, it's funny because it's new music technically, because, you know, if you're going to search up the album on Spotify, it's the first time you're hearing it. But for me, you know, the new album, Not Infinite, it's very old music at this point, because it was written between the years 2011 and 2014. So, like, literally between the time I was in high school to the end of my first year in college. So in a sense, like, the album is kind of a historical relic. You know, it captures a period of time between when I was, you know, a teenager and, you know, and moving out of New Jersey where I was raised to New York to start, you know, this new journey. So, you know, lyrically, it's kind of a relic, but I think musically, you know, the music definitely changed a lot over the course of 5 years. You know, because basically, I had to record the album twice. The first time we didn't make it through, and the second time, that's what you're now hearing. And there was just a constantly changing array of session musicians, singers, you know, and yeah, there was a lot of turnover in the lineup of that it took to make the album, and all of the different musicians that I played the music with over the years through those different jams and through those different performances, the music evolved over time. So that's, you know, that's how I guess in a way it's musically, it's more forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. That definitely makes sense. And you had mentioned like recording it almost twice. And I know the first time it was basically like scrapped. Can you tell me about like kind of like what happened around that?
Sure. And I also just want to briefly say that I go into sort of this history and backstory in the digital booklet for the album, and listeners can just get that by joining our email list, and they'll get a password, and it's hosted on our website. But so yeah, what happened with the first production was that was between 2014 and 2016, and I had partnered up at my college, and ultimately the production fell apart because of a working dispute between myself and them. We got, you know, there was an issue about that we wanted to re-record the drums. And there was, you know, basically a disagreement over how to do that and what the cost of that would be. And, you know, I also want to be honest. I think looking back, you know, I probably would have handled that situation a little differently than I would have now. I think there was definitely mistakes that were made on all sides, you know, throughout that process. And that's kind of the other, you know, like the most important thing that I learned throughout the whole 5 year process of making this album was I really learned the value of my work and the value of another musician's work, and just, you know, how to, more important than the process of writing a song and recording an album was I learned how to actually work and get something done, you know, with limited budget, with limited resources, and how to, you know, make people feel like their input and their work and their contribution is respected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I mean, like, and going back to the idea of like the community, like that's obviously such an important thing in that as well. So it makes sense that kind of like all those pieces like came together for you. And you mentioned like the idea of kind of like putting things together on a limited budget and stuff, and like the video for River Styx is like super in depth, and I'm sure like for anyone making a music video for like a 7+ minute song is kind of daunting. But like, could you talk a little bit about like the process of putting that together?
Sure. So I have to give a huge amount of credit to the production team that worked with me on that, which actually started which also started way back in, I guess, 2015, while I was still in college, and I met Jacques Nerpo, who was, you know, a classmate of mine. We were working in the college in the gym together in the weight rooms, and then years later that materialized into the production for this video, and so basically, you know, myself and Jacques Nerpo, we assembled the team. One of the rappers on the live album, his cinematographer, whose name is Teddy Cruz, ended up being our cinematographer for this project. And then Jacques Nerpo brought in two of his other collaborators, Crystal Jefferson and Raquel Reyes, who did the makeup, and yeah, she did the makeup and the special effects design for the video. And And then I helped bring in the team of actors, and we just did it. We had several production meetings throughout the spring where we developed the idea for the story, and developed where we would shoot it and what time of day we would shoot it. Luckily Raquel was able to get some very nice equipment, because she works at the college film department. And I had a good friend from New Jersey, Sierra Hudson, who was able to drive in and lend us her car and also serve as a stunt double for the scenes with the car. Jochner sat in the trunk of the car with the camera to film me running down Broadway in East New York and Brooklyn. So in the middle of traffic. So yeah, it just, I think just overall the music video came together through, some careful planning and preparation, and just using whatever resources we had available. We honestly made it for almost nothing. I literally spent about $100 to make the video. which, I really think we got away with murder on that. But that's just what I would say. I guess to any young creator, when you're starting out, you have to use what's available. You have to use your network. You have to use your friends. You just have to try to do a lot with very little, because, because you don't have any funding. You don't have a record label or a production company or anything behind you.
Yeah. And you had mentioned the digital booklet a little while ago, and which is also really well put together, similar to the video. And can you talk about a little bit about that drive that you have and kind of the mindset behind how you present yourself?
Sure. So, when I think about, my trajectory in my music career and where I want to get to, I jokingly say that there's two people that I really have in mind, and, two things I want to accomplish is I want to bring my mom, I want to bring my mother home a Grammy Award someday, just because I feel like that's the only aspect of the music, that's the only metric of success in the music industry that she would easily understand. And I know it would make her really proud. And then I also want to bring a Grammy Award back to my high school cross country and track and field coach, Mr. Osen, who I remember when I was in high school and even after I graduated high school, and I told him that I wanted to pursue a career in music, he gave me as harsh an assessment as could possibly have been given. He basically said, music, you can't go anywhere in music. You can't go anywhere as a guitarist. And I said, but what if I was a virtuoso guitarist like Eddie Van Halen? Would you be giving me the same advice? And he said, yeah, but you're not Eddie Van Halen, so I wouldn't give you that advice. And at the time it seemed like really rude for him to say that. But honestly, looking back on it now, I kind of wonder if he was just doing reverse psychology on me, and if he was just trying to give me the harshest possible assessment to motivate me, because it definitely has motivated me. So, I guess just to sum it up, and to tie it back to the whole activism thing, of music to bring people together and to be a catalyst for positive change in the world. And yeah, it's something that I've dedicated myself to for better or worse. And I just at the moment, I don't see myself doing anything else in the long term. So I guess that's what motivates my decision making to try to go as hard as I can with it.
For sure. Yeah. And it was funny, you're saying oh, what if I was a virtuoso like Eddie Van Halen? But I feel like a lot of the guitar work, especially on the album, is very technically proficient and stuff. So can you talk a little bit? I mean, I guess we haven't actually hit specifically on the music style either. So I'm curious about kind of your journey through music and like some of your influences and stuff along the way.
Sure. And I want to take the moment again to give credit to a very talented individual. So there's two guitarists on the album. There's myself and there's Zohe Muniz, who was another kid that I met at college. So if you listen to the solos on the album, some of the kind of bluesier, more classic rock inspired solos, those are mine. But then the really like shreddy, neoclassical, you know, kind of sounding solos, those are Zohabe. So we have both sides of that throughout the record. Now, as far as my guitar playing, you know, Tony Iommi and Kirk Hammett, and I guess for more modern influences, you know, Brent Hinds, Mastodon, Paul Wagoner, Between the Buried and Me, and some of that stuff. But death and I also, you know, I've been listening, you know, in recent years, I've been listening to a lot of different stuff, like, you know, Fela Kuti and Kendrick Lamar and you know, I don't know, Anderson .Paak or you know, some classic jazz. So I've been, you know, those are some of the, I guess, disparate sounds that I try to bring onto this record and just into my music in general. Zohabe is very, very much a student of, you know, guys like Alexi Leho, who is oh my god, he would kill me if I got this wrong.
Children of Bodom?
Is he? Or is he
I don't know.
Yeah, I guess he is. Yeah, let's go with that, Children of Bodom. But he loves Alexi Leho. He loves Sinister Gates. Zohabe is very much a modern you know, guitar player stylistically, and you know, he likes to spend his time practicing stuff like eight finger tapping, which I tip my hat to him for that.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, you kind of mentioned like a lot of those different influences, and the kind of tagline, I guess, in your bio is kind of like heavy metal band with an identity crisis, which and like bringing in, I know in a couple of the songs on the album, there's like horns and stuff like that. So can you talk a little bit about how you kind of like balance those different influences and how you bring all those different collaborators that you have into the process?
I don't want to give away too much info just yet, but the next Death is a Business record is going to have a very different sound from this record. And as far as, you know, the genres of music that you can easily identify. But what I think will be consistent, and I think what listeners will see consistent, and also even if you listen to the live record or the Cheer single, they both sound very different from this record. But I think what listeners will see consistent throughout all of the Death is a Business work is, you know, just a fondness for dynamics. So, you know, when, you know, I talked to you about my guitar playing influences, but as far as my songwriting influences, you know, I was hugely influenced by stuff like Pink Floyd and Yes, and you know, a lot of the classic prog rock stuff, and then even like later in my years, you know, I really liked artists like Kendrick Lamar, who has a very dynamic sound, even though his music obviously sounds totally different from something like Pink Floyd. So I think for me, you know, balancing different influences, you know, managing the identity crisis, the way that I approach that is I just want to create, you know, I think we want to create an experience for listeners where within one song they get taken on a journey. So whether that's over the course of 3 or 4 minutes or over the course of 10 or 13 minutes, I want them to take this whole roller coaster ride through these different emotions and moods and tempos.
Yeah, I definitely think that's like one of the things that I connect with, because I'm not like, you know, typically a super metal guy, but like you said, like those dynamics and the journey and stuff is definitely something that I connected with. is that you had mentioned earlier when we were talking about the community and stuff, how a lot of the stuff in New York is kind of like a little bit like dog eat dog, and like kind of with the process, like with the goal of just like getting as many fans as possible. Does that like pull you in different directions as far as like musically versus like commercially?
So I think, so, you know, what I will say about New York is I think New York has definitely influenced me musically. It's obviously a super diverse city. You know, I've been exposed to all different kinds of music since I've been here, stuff like hip hop, stuff like salsa, bachata, Afrobeat, you know, bossa nova, Brazilian music. I mean, my mother is Brazilian, but funnily enough, it wasn't until I moved to New York that I actually started being around Brazilian music. so all, you know, like all of that is, and obviously just the, you know, the people, you know, are more diverse than in any other major city. So I think all of that has definitely shaped me as a musician and as an artist. And to your question about, you know, about managing, I guess, you know, from a business perspective, about how to gain fans and build an audience in New York. I think the thing that I want to say about that is that there's a huge tension, as a, you know, that you face as an artist in New York, because you want to be, you know, you want to be creative, and you want to just do whatever you want and not necessarily worry about how commercially viable it is. But you know, you have to put a roof over your head, you have to pay your rent, which is very expensive. So you have to, yeah, you like there is a pressure to, you know, if you're going to be successful as, you know, as a musician, no less, in the city, you have to develop a broader audience. So, but I don't, you know, you could read that in a cynical way. You know, there's very much a stigma in the rock and metal communities against selling out. But I think the concept of selling out as an artist or as a musician is inherently subjective. You know, some people might have told me years ago that, you know, me being a metal artist would be selling out by having songs with rapping, or by, you know, by like dressing a certain way, you know, to appeal to more people, but or by, you know, having softer vocals to try to appeal to more people. But for me, I think my goal as an artist is to try to reach as broad and as diverse a range of audiences as possible. So yeah, that's, I think that's also a part of the identity crisis behind the music.
Yeah, no, I mean, that definitely makes sense. And I feel like, you know, like you said, the whole concept of like selling out is kind of very, like you said, subjective and like outdated in a way. Kind of like, as long as you're like staying true to yourself and kind of following what, like your own inspiration and stuff, it's like that's kind of the most important thing. And I love like the genre blending that has become a lot more popular like in the last few years and stuff. Like, it's brought me to so many different kinds of music that I might not necessarily have listened to otherwise, and like really opened me up to a lot more kinds of things. So like, I definitely like, I like that stuff a lot. And then, I mean, I guess hitting on a couple of like the songs specifically, I feel like your kind of like lyric style is not as literal as a lot of the music that I listen to, but probably like Familiar Streets seems to be like the most like literal one, talking about like your childhood home and it being foreclosed on and stuff. So could you tell me a little bit about like the kind of story behind that one?
Yes. So when I was, how old was I? When I was 15, when I was 15 years old, so this was while I was still in high school in New Jersey, our house was foreclosed on, because of, I'll just say because of financial regularities. There was some things being done that should not have been done, and unfortunately, it dissolved my parents' relationship you know, their marriage, you know, it kind of broke the family apart a little bit. We all ended up moving out of that. So this was in Hopatcong, New Jersey, which is a town in Sussex County. We all ended up moving. So it was, you know, myself, my older brother, Danny, my oldest sister, Natalia, and my two parents. One by one, we all ended up moving out of that house. My mom was the first to leave. She got an apartment in Netcong, New Jersey, which is a couple of towns over. I definitely had a lot of resentment and anger towards her for doing that. About a year or so later, my dad, who had been unemployed for almost that whole time, ended up moving. He got a new job in Raleigh, North Carolina. So he moved down there. He's been there ever since. This was 2012. And then my sister left to go move in with my mom. So there was a period of time where it was just myself and my brother Danny in the house, and then eventually we moved out, you know, completely, and we moved in with my mom. So that's, you know, that's kind of the summation of that story. In February 2013, my brother committed suicide, which is also the subject of the, you know, the song A Mother's Touch. And then, you know, that was it during my senior year of high school. And then obviously I graduated and moved to New York. So, you know, all of that is what that song Familiar Streets is about. It's about that whole years long process of physically moving out of the house, but then also physically moving out of New Jersey to a new city, and then kind of spiritually losing touch with, you know, the people and place that I grew up with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I mean, like, now that you're kind of farther removed from that than you were, like, when you wrote the song, like, how has your, like, interpretation of it kind of changed?
I think what I would say is I think that it's a very special relationship that you have to your roots, to your hometown, and not even just to your hometown, but even to, you know, everything that came before you, you know, your parents, your family, your parents' family, you know, both my parents are immigrants. My dad's a Jew from the Soviet Union. My mom's from the northeast of Brazil. So there's a lot of different homes that I have a relationship with, but I guess what I would say is, as I've gotten older, I think that it's incumbent on you as an individual to maintain, the relationships with the homes that are important to you. And it's hard work. It's difficult work, you know, even just to keep in touch with, you know, my sister and my two parents. It's something that I don't do as good of a job as I can. But that, I think that if you want to maintain those relationships, if you want to stay in touch with your roots and your history and your ancestry, I think you can do it, but it's definitely not easy, you know, especially when we're all out here in the world, just trying to get ahead, trying to live our lives and pursue our careers and everything.
For sure. Yeah. And I know you had mentioned, like, A Mother's Touch being about, like, your brother's suicide. And, I think it's interesting, like, the fact that it was in a very different, like, form, like, on the live record as well. What was it kind of like for you, I guess, being that, like, open, and obviously it's, like, a really rough, emotionally, like, rough song. What was it like for you kind of, like, being that open, and also, like, both in the song as it appears on the album and kind of, like, bringing it in with other people for, like, the live album?
So first I would say that, you know, I started writing that song, as far as just the text of it, you know, what would eventually become the lyrics, probably like the day after my brother killed himself. So I think I remember, writing down some ideas either on paper or, you know, in my phone or whatever. And that was the raw text that ended up becoming the song. My reason for seeing that song through to completion and recording and releasing it is, I guess I wanted to try to come to terms with the, you know, all the conflicted feelings I felt, as, you know, as far as he was concerned, you know, my anger towards him, my guilt about the situation, you know, feeling responsible, you know, wondering who is to blame. Was he to blame? Am I to blame? Is my family to blame? You know, there's a lot of that contained in the song. And as far as, you know, releasing it into the world, you know, when I moved to New York, no one knew me. So it was easy to just pretend that he never existed. And, you know, I've been in New York over 6 years now. And it's literally been up until now that I've even, you know, been comfortable to talk to people openly about this. So, you know, releasing the song is definitely a way for me to more in a more healthy way, come to terms openly, with the world about what happened to him. As far as the live album, the live version of it goes, I guess what I would say about that is, well, let's put it this way: no one who appeared on that recording actually. No one who appeared on the live recording of that song actually knows about him or what happened to him or what the song is about. So I guess I would say that I hope that the song is relatable enough that, and I wrote it that way. I wrote it to be relatable enough that people can read the emotion and the honesty in it, even if they don't know my specific backstory that's part of it.
You're definitely like very strong for like I said, like putting that out there. And I'm glad that it has helped you. And I think it will probably help other people as well who are either like dealing with the same similar situations and stuff like that. And I'm curious, like you mentioned, like the live album, it not kind of having the same backstory kind of as it does on, or the same context, I guess, as it does on the album. How do you think that affected kind of like the way that either like you viewed the song or that like people now listening to like the finished version view it?
I would hope when people listen to the live version. So, you know, I think the studio version is very much, you know, a presentation of this whole story with all its different twists and turns. I hope that when people listen to the live version, I hope what they hear is, you know, a group of different musicians, each exchanging ideas and feelings off of each other within this one performance. So, you know, the rapper Dare, who does the opening verse to that song, he actually mentions his little brother in that verse. So I think that he came to that with something personal and intimate to himself. And, you know, I think that verse kind of talks about, just, you know, wanting to make people proud as a rapper, as a hip hop artist, and, you know, wanting to make your family proud. That's the vibe that I get from that verse. And then Mello, who does the, you know, the backing vocals and some of the lead vocals on that song. I know that she's been through a lot of her own, you know, hardships and challenges in her life and with her family. And, you know, I know that when she sang that song, again, she didn't know what it meant to me, but I know that it meant something to her.
Yeah, I think it's really cool, like, the way that it can be, like, open to interpretation that way, and that, like, the live version specifically is kind of, like, a meeting of the minds and kind of, like, a melding of you, all these different people with these different experiences and how they kind of can connect to the similar feeling around it.
Here we are at the mid-show shout-out once again. This week, I'd like to highlight Edupunks, a podcast by Craig Vitamin. The show features interviews with educators, musicians, and everyday disruptors, talking about education, politics, DIY, community, music, and anything else you can think of. Edupunks recently came back from a hiatus with an episode featuring Josh Sear of The World is a Beautiful Place and I'm No Longer Afraid to Die, which is a great hopping on place for those new to the podcast. Each and every person Craig speaks to is unique and has something of value to offer to the listener and get them thinking, so I highly suggest you give it a shot.
I always like to ask as the last question, kind of either for just like a piece of advice or like something that you've been thinking about lately that you'd like to share, either about like music specifically or just life in general?
That's a big one. Okay, so I'll say this actually, which is something that has been on my mind a lot very recently. You know, and I say this also as a writer, journalist, focusing on drug policy and, you know, other issues like that, and as a musician. I think that as creators, as artists, as, you know, people that have a voice, you know, whether musically or otherwise, we have, I want us to recognize that we have power and we have influence and we have a say. And because we have that power, we have to exercise it responsibly. And, you know, this is something that I face every day as a writer. When I write a story about a topic, I know that what I choose not to say has just as much impact as what I do choose to say. And the people I don't speak to says just as much as the people I do choose to speak to for sources. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, the same thing with music. Who I choose to work with on a record, or, you know, to put on an event or a show, you know, who I choose to reach out to in my audience, what I choose to do as an artist, you know, when you reach a certain level of fame or notoriety, and I'm not going to say any names, but some people have disappointed me. We have to use that power responsibly. And I think for every creator, that means something different. For me at this point, most recently, what that has meant is it's meant using my platform and using my voice, to support people of color and to support, you know, low income people, people that are suffering the most in this country, people that don't have housing, people that are discriminated against by the police, people that are, you know, targeted, in the criminal justice system, you know, just, these are obviously the issues that I tackle, you know, in my capacity as a drug writer. Mm-hmm. But I try to bring that, I try to consider that in the music that I make as well. So for this event that we're doing in December, I want it to be a space, where people of color can feel safe and where they can feel welcome, and where they can feel engaged with, you know, not just as audience members, but also as leaders, as, you know, people performing or people presenting. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'd say for right now. That's something that I'm trying to hold myself accountable to at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that definitely speaks to me as well. It's something like I do always try to be like very thoughtful in the kind of like decisions I make and stuff. And like, even with this podcast, like I've always loved interviews because, just like, I would rather give the artists that I love a platform to speak about their music and like the messages that they want to promote than I would like, you know, filtering it through my lens and like writing a review and stuff like that. And like, yeah, and with this podcast, like it's like an internal rule to myself that like there's no two episodes in a row that I'm going to have with like straight white cis men, like bands that are all that. So, I mean, I think just like the idea of kind of like making those decisions and kind of like just being like kind of like present in the decisions that you're making instead of kind of just like going with the flow and stuff like that and like going with like the status quo and everything. I think that's like so important for sure. So I think that's definitely like really good, good advice.
And you know, I just want to really quickly say also, it should be noted that to whatever extent that, you know, us as journalists or creators fail in those goals, it's not even necessarily, you know, because of bad intent or anything. I think that, you know, a lot of the times when you're working under deadlines or when you're working under like external pressures to turn out work quickly and efficiently, I think you find yourself in a lot of situations where there's people who it's just easier to work with or easier to talk to. And, you know, a lot of times it's harder to do outreach and step outside of your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, it's a difficult balance for sure, but it's just something for us to be conscious of. And, you know, if anyone's in the New York area and they want to come to the event, it's going to be Friday, December 6th, 8 p.m. And they can just go to deathisabusiness.com and I'll make sure that the event link and the flyer is there for them.
The end is near. The interview has wrapped up and I'll keep this outro brief. If you enjoyed this conversation, please check out the new Death is a Business album, Not Infinite, as well as their very different but very cool live acoustic album from last year. And if you're in the New York area, the band's Loud Music, Loud Politics, Loud Weed event sounds like it'll be an awesome time. Thanks so much to Alex for taking the time to chat, and to you for taking the time to listen. A special thank you, as always, to The Alternative for helping to promote the show, Kaylin West of Tiny Stills for the theme song, and Michaela Jane Palermo for the artwork. You can keep up to date by subscribing to the podcast and following the show on Twitter and Instagram at Fly on the Call Pod. Each Monday, I post a hint at that week's guest, and if you're the first one to guess it right, you'll get to hear the episode early. Feel free to email any questions, comments, or other feedback to me at flyonthecallpod@gmail.com. Catch you all on the flippy flip. Fly on the call.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like The Lumineers, Andy DeFranco, Wolfpack, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask? Good
morning. I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon. Again.